It is time for the Media Beat with David Tarachuk. David joins us, of course, on a Friday morning. We rebroadcast David on the weekend, also following our 12 noon news on Monday as well. And he is still in the idyllic state of Maine. Good morning, David.
Well, hello to you. Yeah, reporting from here instead of the usual place of the media capital of the world, New York City. There couldn't be a greater contrast. Yeah, I'm still in Maine, and I'll be here one more week, I think. I'm really enjoying the change.
It is. I lived in Maine for 1 year, and it's definitely a change from especially if you come out of New York City, Boston, any major city, because it's Maine is its own peculiar place, and it's a great place to be and basically clear the cobwebs out.
Now, yeah, time for thought, time for reflection. It's very quiet. That has to be said, because, of course, I'm not in any of Maine's cities. I'm out in the countryside. It is a wonderful place for just thinking and writing and occasionally, you know, picking up the strands of the media world's craziness and talking about it on a Friday morning with you.
All right. Well, I had a list of things, a laundry list.
You did this week.
But it was upended a little bit yesterday with two events. I will start off the first one that it was upended with. With what's going on in Russia and with, once again, a major critic of Vladimir Putin mysteriously coming down with a sickness, which Russia claims is not a poisoning. But, gosh, you know, I don't know how much people in the world have to see to understand exactly what a strong man Vladimir Putin is in every sense of the word.
Well, yes, it's been a dramatic week for news of all kinds, but there's scarcely anything more dramatic than a politician who's the individual you're talking about, Alexei Navalny, an extraordinarily brave critic of the strongman Vladimir Putin, coming down with an illness, which appears to be, all the circumstantial evidence and all the track record evidence relating to Putin's treatment of dissidents and critics, it certainly looks like another of his poisonings or his people's poisonings. It's almost a bit like the English king who said once, will no one rid me of this troublesome priest? He's speaking about a priest who was a critic of him. And, of course, three knights of the realm took it into their head to go out and assassinate this particular priest. Thomas a Becket was his name. I think that goes on a lot when you've got a strong man in power. People, you know, take it upon themselves often to enact what seems to be the hope of a dictator, that his will should prevail in some argument with someone else, and that someone else ends up dead. In this case, he's still in a coma, and more drama, of course, because his supporters, his family, wanted him out of the country, understandably. He's in Minsk, back in Siberia, where he started off before the plane had to land because of his illness in flight. And he's being treated there by Russian doctors, of course. And in the meantime, the family and supporters have brought in a German ambulance plane. They want him out of Russia and being taken care of somewhere else for understandable reasons, I think you'll agree. And the Russian doctors are now saying, oh, no, he's too ill to travel. And the suspicion is that they don't want him examined somewhere else where remnants of the poison might still be in his system and readily identified as a foreign body. dropped in his tea is the most likely explanation, according to people around him. Dropped in his tea, he paused for a drink in the cafe at the airport before he took off. He's normally much more careful than that, and would normally, people around him say, not drink anything that he hadn't prepared himself or wasn't prepared by someone he knew well. So that's the kind of caution you need if you're a critic of a strongman dictator like Putin. Great friend, it would appear, to our own would-be strongman president. And the message is clear once again as we approach our election that the friends this occupant of the White House at the moment has made around the world, in spite of much evidence that suggests that they're the least appropriate friends for us to have, is still that process of friendship with dictators is still being promoted over the views of our intelligence professionals, who tell us constantly that these are dangerous men that we need to be curtailing, not cultivating.
And before the arrival of President Trump, the United States would have stepped up and be the 401 to send a plane in to take this person out. But Germany has taken over that role for us, at least in this particular instance.
Yes, Angela Merkel, the strong woman. and they've got heft. Germany has a joint operation now with Russia, a major pipeline, and it's vital to Russia. And Germany knows, of course, how to use its economic power, always has done, and when it had power, that is, when it has had power. And clearly it's being made clear that Germany wants to step in and wants to help on the side of the injured dissident, and she has the wherewithal to force her will. Let's see how that plays out. It's looking like a kind of deadlock in Minsk at the moment. That's a good headline for the story, I think, deadlock in Minsk.
All right. Now, before I go on and hit any other topics, I don't want to possibly by accident steal your thunder, so why don't we do your special segment right now?
I have no thunder to be stolen, but I would want to do a shout-out in my Find the Good and Praise It this week, which calls for a fanfare.
Okay.
For a journal, for a weekly magazine, far from here. So when you play the trumpet fanfare, which I hope you will do now, it needs to be extra loud. We're talking about a magazine in London.
Here we go. There you go.
There we go. Find the good and praise it, I'm saying. And the people I'm fanfaring are the workers who put together every week at the political magazine in Britain, The New Statesman. And it's rather refreshing to take a look, as I do occasionally, at media around the world to see how they're doing, and in part to see how they're reporting on America, because, of course, they report every media, all the media in every country now, are reporting very differently on the United States from the way they used to. Almost dismissive, treating it as a joke a lot of the time, and really just not taking it as seriously as they used to. But it's always good to get their analysis of all sorts of things around the world. And the New Statesman this week has done something very very useful in two directions. One is the subject we've just been talking about, Alexei Navalny. They've done a very snappy background piece on explaining exactly who he is, how he's important, all the extraordinary work he's doing as almost like an investigative journalist himself. He's been traveling all over Russia, including Siberia, making documentary films about corruption. He has created an anti-corruption unit, and it makes these films and posts them on YouTube. One of the many things he's done to annoy Vladimir Putin. And the whole story is the whole background story is told very fully in this week's New Statesman, which is always good on international affairs. And what I was struck by this week and wanted to fanfare is an analysis about Britain, but it has relevance for other places too, that how the state of Britain, the so-called United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, to give it its full title, is likely to be affected politically by the COVID crisis. It's basically sketching out a scenario in which the stresses and strains are being very clearly felt, but could lead, and it's a speculative piece, but a well-informed speculative piece, suggesting all this could lead to the breakup of the United Kingdom, which is something you and I have discussed quite a lot in this slot. Scotland is handling COVID, for instance, under its first minister, kind of regional governor in a way for Scotland, Nicola Sturgeon, who's a member of the Scottish National Party, who in its long-term view wants to see the independence of Scotland, has been handling the COVID crisis remarkably well. She strikes a very considerable contrast with Boris Johnson in England, who, you know, claiming to govern all of the UK, but in fact being all over the map, as you might say, in the COVID crisis. And Scotland's numbers have been held down very strikingly compared with England. And yet again, we rather like the way that Scotland voted against Brexit when England voted for it, and now that we've now left, we actually have exited the European Union as a nation as a whole. I still think of myself partly as British. I have dual citizenship with America and the UK. But UK is now out of Europe, but Scotland has made it very clear that it really, really wants to be in Europe. And add COVID now to the list of grievances that Scotland has. And unsurprisingly, you'll see public opinion polls reporting more and more support for total independence in Scotland, away from England. And then over in Northern Ireland, what's been made clear by the COVID crisis there, as the New Statesman so carefully reports, is that the absurdity of that border across Ireland, separating the northern six counties into Ulster, which is an old province of Ireland, but it's the province which Britain has held on to, and of course is the cause of. Has been the cause of so much tension and so much violence in the 20th century. There's now a peace agreement, but the absurdity of that line being there at all has been demonstrated enormously in the COVID crisis, because Northern Ireland had to look constantly to Westminster, to London, for overall guidance in handling the COVID crisis, where, you know, an island-wide approach to a health crisis like this was obviously what most people thought was the most sensible thing. So again, the border has come up, rather like it's bound to come up in trade now that only part of Ireland is out of Europe in the new post-Brexit world. So all these stresses and strains on the so-called United Kingdom mapped out so clearly in this remarkable, long, very long, but well worth it article in the New Statesman. And one of the things that's highlighted, of course, is Nicola Sturgeon in Scotland doing these really good, giving us really good examples of leadership and handling the COVID crisis so well. And her daily briefings, in a way, would remind many an American, I think, many a New Yorker, certainly, of the daily briefings that came from, still coming from the governor of New York. And such a contrast from local, state in America approaches to COVID and national, in Scotland's case, approaches to COVID compared with the national capital and its attempts to cope with the crisis. The contrast being struck every day between Cuomo and Trump are echoed in Britain by this contrast between Nicola Sturgeon and Boris Johnson.
Well, we will move on here. And we have reached really a theoretical tipping point. I'm 67, and I have I'm always a history buff. I hated medieval history, but American history I've always loved.
I apologize for my reference to Thomas Becket and Henry in that case.
Went completely over my head, David. Okay. What happened yesterday with the indictment of Steve Bannon? If you sit back and you take that indictment by itself and put it to the side, and look at now six top people who have worked with the President of the United States, not only to get him elected, but have worked in the government with him after he was elected. Five are convicted, and now there's a sixth indictment. And even what goes one step further, which makes this even more embarrassing, is that one of the other people happens to be a relative to Betsy DeVos, who was, of course, the head of the schools in this country. So now,
Education Secretary.
So now you look at this. Other than hearing Tammany Hall and a few things out of Mayor Daley's Chicago, even they now pale in comparison to just an amazing 3.5 years of, I don't know what to call it, in the White House. It's simply mind-boggling why this doesn't really upset more Americans.
Yeah, well, it's another instance of reinforcement, really, of the notion an underlining of the question that must be on many people's minds, or at least an observation, at least, that Trump really knows how to pick 'em, doesn't he? all these people associated with his campaign who are now either in jail or in one case pardoned, of course, and now a new one indicted on the grim and simple and horribly banal charge of fraud. And in this particular case, fraud of a particularly pathetic nature. Organizing a private funding of building of a wall and appealing through personality based appeals centering on a wounded veteran. It's sad, and in a way, in that word that Trump often uses in his tweets, meaning pathetic. And this is an instance of it coming, once again, very close. I mean, to someone who has been, at least, very close to Trump. Trump's brain, in many ways, was the way that he was regarded in the time that he was the most immediate counselor to Trump. Strategist was a favorite word for people in the immediate circle to apply to Bannon. Well, he's a strategist who decides to become a fraudster, a suggestion that many in the media are making now, that it's more confirmation that Trumpism, if such a thing exists, is always something of a scam, and certainly an opportunity for financial scams, whether it's to do with Trump's own hotel, which houses governmental people and overseas government, people representing overseas governments too, and as former President Obama made very clear in his very striking speech to the virtual Democratic convention, that the office of President of the United States should not be regarded as an opportunity to enrich oneself. One's own company and enrich the fortunes of your supporters either. The Bannon indictment is another low point. Let's put it no more strongly than that. And it's prompted, I think, one of the finest pieces of ironic satire this week from Andy Borowitz, a neighbor of yours, I know, he suggested that, well, he's concocted a wonderful story about a new cognitive test for President Trump. He's really good at remembering what a person, a woman, a man, a camera, a TV are like, but he cannot remember the two words Steve Bannon.
It's you know, and you look at this, and here's what makes this even sadder. It's like, for people that don't know about Steve Bannon, whether you agree with his politics or not, that put that aside, the man was wealthy anyway. He came from financial.
The word pathetic comes to mind again.
Yeah, you know, he and so now here's, you put a man in this position, and what does he do with his position? He uses that position to take money from people.
Allegedly,
that's right. This is, he's innocent until proven guilty, but he allegedly takes money from the people who elected Donald Trump to do something for them. And what does he potentially do? He does this. And what was amazing about that indictment, as I did watch the news yesterday on that, not on the mainstream networks, but the Cyrus Vance's office did something very, very interesting yesterday. And that's, they just didn't release news about the indictment. They gave you hook, line, and sinker, every reason why he was indicted. And you look at that, and you don't have to be a legal scholar or a legal student to understand, they have a lockdown case. It's amazing the specifics they put out with that release.
Yeah, it was a court reporter's delight, the indictment and the background put out by the DA's office. And you know, yet again, just the sort of banality of the diversion of funds into personal pockets was remarkable, and of course itemized in considerable and substantial detail. So as you say, it reads like a very strong case.
It is another low point. We will move on from that low point to, once again, the saga of the United States Post Office, which the Senate is looking at today and the House will look at this weekend or on Monday, where, once again, it is a clear case of a political appointee going above and beyond the call of duty to set things in motion for the president of the United States. And, I, you know, David, I'm so tired of hearing the people claim that the post office is operating in the red. I have been shouting this to who will hear it for years. The post office only operates on the line or in the red for one reason. They are the only agency that is required to completely fund their retirement fund 20 years out. So there is no room. They'll never get out of that red. People don't understand that. They're the only branch of government, and they're a quasi-branch of government, but they have to show on paper that they can fund those retirement accounts 20, 25, 30 years out. And that's the only reason they currently operate in the red every year.
Yeah, a restriction that was placed upon them by Congress, by government. So yes, it's a self-induced restriction in a sense. If you are the government and you're saying this quasi-governmental arm of your administration, or at least to your administrative services to the nation, then you know you have to live with the consequences of what you decide to do with. You know, every single restriction and every single condition that you place on the entity's operations, and even if this doesn't, all this supposed attempt at new efficiencies, as they have been described by DeJoy, the new postmaster general, even if they don't end up hobbling the post office further, even to the point of undermining it to destruction, you will certainly have effected what certainly will have been produced by all this controversy and all this heated animosity about it will set to undermine the post office in another way, and in a much more vital way, I think, in that it will... And I think the whole controversy has been manufactured by the Oval Office anyway to do exactly this. It's to undermine faith in our elections through the measure of absentee balloting and mail-in balloting. Just to have the whiff of the suspicion that in some way your vote won't count is a classic way of anti-democratic forces undermining the process of democracy.
Go back all the way to the Pony Express and the post office, even though people always complain when the cost of stamps go up, but they get over it. Really, there's one section of government that is, I think, almost universally admired, and that happens to be the United States Post Office. And
yes,
what's
it's
great,
an interesting area to attempt to make a political issue. I think it's a, you know, it's doomed to failure because I think you're right. The post office is a much admired element of our citizenry's life as a whole. However, I need to give a rider to that there is a new generation coming up now that fairly well established, really, people well into their 30s. Who don't necessarily have the post office so close to their hearts, people who stopped writing letters a long time ago. It hasn't quite got the resonance that I think some of us oldsters think it has. However, if you're going to pick an area in which you're going to have a political fight, I'd have thought that on balance, if only because of the familiar figure of the letter carrier, most who in most neighborhoods is a beloved character. I think it's the last area that I would want to stage a political battle because it's more than likely to backfire. And it's very interesting that the House, as you say, the Senate today will be grilling the Postmaster General in committee, but the House has been recalled. Yeah. Precisely on this issue, so I think it's going to be a very interesting area of contestation as we're now into the 70s in terms of numbers of the number of days before the election, and we're on a very very slippery slope here for how the Trump campaign is going to use this issue. It may, as I say, backfire, but it's certainly going to be rather bloody.
All right, we have about 2 minutes left. Just get your feeling about the virtual convention. Actually, I think if they can really work on this format a little more, I think they should probably keep these conventions virtual from now on.
In many ways, isn't it a great relief to be watching it without the whole circus aspect of huge auditorium, hard to control. You've got now a well-produced event. Just like a bunch of event planners have come together with a bunch of television producers and say, well, how could we do it in a way that makes a better show? And that's what's happened. I mean, it's crisp, it's clear. There have been some banal moments and some, yeah, you know, really kind of cringy moments too. But on the whole, isn't it much better to have it cut and tailored the way it is? There's some, I mean, old-timers will regret the jamboree aspect of it, but I think they tend to be, political wonks and enthusiasts rather than people who want their politics to mean something and have substance to it rather than to be a form of entertainment and the way that many party workers feel about the national conventions, that it's a time to get together. There's a community spirit that matters, but it only matters to them. It doesn't matter to the electorate. The only thing I'd say that I would regret about traditional conventions being consigned to the dustbin of history is that you possibly wouldn't have had the kind of event that happened in 2004, where ultra careful selection that has taken place this year in the confined and orchestrated circumstances of a virtual convention, where it's all, a bit like Hollywood Squares. You're looking at people in little boxes, and they have timed, the contributions from the podium are always timed, but it's a lot more flexible than a big live amphitheater, and it's very much more controlled in the Zoom kind of conference that we've been seeing in the virtual convention. But the sort of thing that happened in 2004 is very unlikely to happen in this virtual setting. And I'm thinking of, in particular, the way that a senator from Illinois electrified the Democratic convention that year, a young aspiring politician called Barack Obama. And it wasn't so much his speech that was so striking, it was its effect on the crowd. And if it wasn't for that, I don't think we would have ever had President Obama. So I think it's a trade-off. But I think on balance, I'm happy to see the calmer, quieter, more rational version of a national convention that we're seeing in this virtual form.
All right. As always, David, we'll check in with you next week. Have a great week, and we'll speak to you again in that beautiful state of Maine next week.
You will. Thanks a lot.
Take care. David Tarachuk with the Media Beat here on Robin Hood Radio.